This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with an Occupy activist from Des Moines, Iowa.
Des Moines, a city on the Mississippi River in the middle of the heartland, is rising up in solidarity with Occupied Wall Street here in New York City. We'll discuss the case of three people murdered at Guantanamo, whose murders have been exposed by whistleblowers.
The government claims suicide, but in fact murders. Pardis Kebriai just argued the cases in the court. The courts in this country now are like roach motels. You go in, but the cases never come out.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, every year around this time, the General Assembly has a vote on whether to stop the embargo against Cuba. And every year we hope there's going to be a change. What happened this year?
The vote on October 25th in the General Assembly, and remember, it's only an advisory vote because the United States is the one that instituted the embargo in 1960. And the vote in the General Assembly, which represents every nation on the planet, was 186-2. The two countries voting to keep the embargo were the United States and its ally Israel. 186-2. This is the 51st year of the embargo. So the question is, why the embargo? And the answer is simple, and this is what Michael Ratner and I wrote about in our book, Who Killed Che? Cuba had in 1959 a social revolution, revolve. And the people in Cuba on the bottom took over, and the people on the top went left. It was a revolution of classes. The bottom went to the top. You know, that brilliant slogan that Occupy Wall Street people have, we are the 99%. Rulers and owners are the 1%. Well, that's precisely what existed in Cuba. You know, it's a pyramid. In this country, 400 people own 40% of the wealth of this country. And they pretty much call the political shots, too, in both parties. In Cuba, it was the same way. For example, the father of the CIA agent who helped kill Che in 1967, a guy named Villaldo, was worth, in 1959, the year of the Cuban Revolution, he was worth $423 million. He owned a farm of 100,000 acres. 75% of all the land in Cuba was owned by wealthy Americans. And this is what happened. There was a revolution. The people on the top had to vacate, and the people on the bottom took over control of their own country. And that's what caused the United States to institute the blockade. The first thing the Cubans did when the revolution succeeded on New Year's Day of 1959, was instituted a land reform. In those days, your average peasant worked seasonably, didn't even own shoes, was illiterate, ate from hand to mouth, and those were the people that fought in the army, the guerrilla army that was organized by Che and Fidel. And when they succeeded and the American-sponsored dictator Batista left for Miami Beach, when they succeeded, they had a land reform. And they whacked up those big estates, like the 100,000-acre estate, and they handed it out to the people. And they armed the people so they could defend their conquests. The Cuban government said to the United States, we'll pay you for the land that we're nationalizing. You can nationalize land under international law. And we'll pay you according to how much you say the land is worth on the tax returns that you put to the Cuban government every year. Well, the United States didn't go for that, and so they nationalized the land. In retaliation, the United States, which owned the oil refineries, stopped refining oil, so the Cubans had no gasoline. The economy would have ground to a halt. So the Cubans nationalized the oil refineries. Then they nationalized the nickel factories. Then they nationalized the bus company. Then they nationalized the telephone company. And willy-nilly, they brought the whole Cuban economy under the democratic control of the Cuban people. That's what caused the United States to institute the blockade 51 years ago. Why the blockade? The United States wants to restore capitalism to Cuba. They want to restore prior owners to what they used to have. And the Cubans estimate that this has caused a loss of about $1 trillion, $1,000 billion. The blockade is very damaging. For example, if you have an x-ray machine in a hospital and a part breaks, you need a new part so you can x-ray to see if a baby has a broken arm, you can't get the new part because the machine was made in the United States. If they try to get that part from Italy and a boat brings it over and the boat stops in Cuba to give the part for the x-ray machine, it can't come to the United States for 90 days. So they've interfered with Cuban trade. It's made it really impossible for the Cubans to have the normal development of an economy. They've been attacking the Cubans since day one. Even before that, the United States supported the Batista dictatorship militarily for the 3 years it took the guerrillas to win the war. When they lost, the first thing the Cubans did with the land reform, they did the next thing was they had a literacy campaign, because you can't have democracy if people are illiterate. People have to be able to read. And what did the United States do? It sponsored the bandits in the countryside that killed the literacy teachers.
I want to point out, though, the resilience of the Cuban people, despite this tremendously destructive embargo, both practically and politically. They have developed pharmaceuticals on their own. They've engaged in organic farming, a whole wealth of creative responses to a really draconian punishment by the United States government. And so that, well, I think most other countries would have failed totally in light of this 50-year embargo, the Cubans have found a way to survive. Granted, as you've said, with enormous constraints put on how they do trade with other countries, but they have not given up fighting the U.S. And the fact that in the face of all the other countries voting to stop the bloqueo, as it's called, it's stunning to me that year after year, it's Israel and the U.S. that constantly vote to keep it.
Shows you how isolated the American government is in the world, if any one figure could be more illustrative, 186-2. But, you know, that was why Che was in Bolivia. He thought that he could defend the Cuban Revolution by extending it. He thought that if the revolution spread to Latin America, Cuba wouldn't be so isolated and blockaded. You know, the United States forced all the governments of the Caribbean and Latin America, except Mexico, all the governments to break off relations with Cuba. And if the governments wouldn't break off relations with Cuba, they overthrew them. That's what they did to the Bolivian government in 1964. And that's the place where Che chose to try to establish with the Bolivians focal unit to try to recreate what had happened in Cuba and have a guerrilla war that would succeed. And that's the place where the United States found Che and had him executed. And that's the subject of our book, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder, that Orr Books is publishing on November 15th. But it's available, Orr Books, orrbooks.com. And we tell the story of Cuba, and we tell Che's story, and we tell the story of the counter-revolutionary nature of U.S. foreign policy that's been trying since 1959 to overthrow the Cuban Social Revolution.
Michael, I hear that the New York Times last week came out with a new poll that we can really relate to here.
Well, this is the headline above the cut, Wednesday, October 26th. Anxiety over economy, concentration of wealth seen as key issue in a volatile time. And then it goes on to say, almost half the public thinks the sentiment at the root of Occupy movement generally reflects the views of most Americans. With nearly all Americans remaining fearful that the economy is stagnating or deteriorating further, two-thirds of the public said that wealth should be distributed more evenly in the country. 7 of 10 Americans think the policies of congressional Republicans favor the rich. Two-thirds object to tax cuts for corporations, and a similar number prefer increasing income taxes on millionaires. And it goes on and on in that vein. Occupy Wall Street.
Well, thank you, Occupy Wall Street and other Occupies, for really bringing this into the fore. We've been talking about this for years, but I think it does strike a nerve with people all around the country. Even those who at first made fun of the demonstrators, they're getting support now from all walks of life. And I think it does. It goes to this core issue. We need a redistribution of wealth, and we need some sane policies.
The one exception I take with the New York Times is that they only report on 2/3 of the people thinking the Republican Party is the party of the rich. They could say the same thing for the Democratic Party. Obama got most of his money from Wall Street last time, and that's where he's looking to get money again. He wants to raise $1 billion.
He had the same supporters as Bush.
He's getting more money from Wall Street than the Republicans now.
On a positive note, Michael, I think that the Occupy events that are sprouting up around the country in places we've never even heard of, little rural areas, are generating an excitement. And I think the thing that we've talked about on this show for years, a real people's movement that's coming up from the grassroots. The legislators have to, they can't ignore this any longer.
It's exhilarating. Heidi, you know, I live and work right near Liberty Park, and I go over there twice a day, and it's absolutely exhilarating. I never thought I'd live so long to see something like this happen. It's unprecedented in the history of America. It's really fantastic. Not just New York City. I was up in Albany for a Holly Near concert on Friday.
I heard they had a great little gathering.
Holly publicized it. Kicked off that Friday night, and
I heard there was a controversy because the governor and the mayor wanted to shut it down.
That's exactly.
And the police didn't go along with it.
The governor Cuomo wanted to shut it down. The mayor, the mayor didn't want to do it, and told the police not to.
And I heard that the firefighters came and brought donuts and coffee to the protesters.
Ah, that's great.
Yeah, we need more of that.
You know, it reminds me of that of a story I heard about how the Egyptians were sending pizzas to the people in Madison.
Right. That's great.
Now they're sending pizzas to the people at Liberty Square here in New York City. And you know what the pizzas are called? Occupies.
Abuse of authority, including excessive use of force, are on the increase as more Occupy movements around the country are being forced to disperse. Last week, 37 demonstrators were arrested in Des Moines, Iowa, when 24 state troopers closed in on the Occupy movement there, enforcing a curfew, arbitrarily enforcing a rarely used curfew in a local park. Still more people were arrested in the downtown area that same night. While capturing his friend being pepper-sprayed in the face on video and then arrested, an officer directed Justin Norman to back off the sidewalk into another area. Justin was then arrested for trespassing and interfering with official acts. The officer grabbed his camera, but other protesters were able to wrestle it away from him. We talk now with Justin Norman to hear more details about his story. Justin Norman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thank you.
We're delighted to have a report straight from Des Moines, Iowa, because we understand that last week 37 demonstrators were arrested after state troopers closed down an Occupy movement by enforcing a curfew in a local park. And we understand that you were videotaping the arrests. Can you give us a brief recap of what happened?
Yeah, there's an 11 o'clock curfew at the park that's normally not enforced. In fact, some of the people that were amongst the protesters had said that they would walk their dogs in this park normally after 11 o'clock, and the police didn't care. But because there was something political going on in the park that night, the Iowa State Patrol brought out about 24 troopers by my count. They began mass arresting people maybe about a quarter after 11 o'clock. And I was down there doing some videotaping. There were several other people doing videotaping as well, including some news organizations. The protesters had all lined up and were standing at first, but then began to sit as the police approached. And the police began to be kind of strangely brutal with some of the protesters. One of the guys this guy was leading the chant, and they asked him if he'd like to stay and be arrested or go, and he said he would go. And as he was leaving the park, they shoved him on the ground, and he cut open his knees, and then they dragged him off to a police van and arrested him anyway. Another person was pushed to the ground. The state troopers stepped on his head and then struck him in the face multiple times. another guy named Rod, who is, I believe, a 10-year Air Force veteran, was refusing to move when he was asked to leave the park, and he had his arms linked with another protester. In response, one of the state troopers maced him in the face and then dragged him to the curb. They had him handcuffed at that point, and they were going to put him into a police van. But he was sitting on the curb, and I was videotaping him from the edge of the sidewalk. And the state trooper who had maced him noticed this and told me to step back and motioned me not across the street but into the park. So I was backing up in the direction he was directing me with his hand. And at a certain point, I said, "Oh, how far do you want me to get back?" Because I was still, of course, wanting to videotape the aftermath of the macing. And at this point, I think one of my friends was taking video of the interaction between myself and the trooper. And I looked afterward, and I'm about 20 feet away from the state trooper when he's still telling me to move back. And he tells me, if I don't continue to move back, then I'm going to be charged with interference and trespassing, even though he's motioned me onto the closed park property himself. And that's exactly what happened. Was I didn't move back any further than that. I felt like that was a fair distance to be back away from Rod. And they arrested me. They tried to confiscate my camera. They took the camera, and I yelled out to one of my friends, who will remain nameless, but he ran up and tore the camera out of the two troopers' hands and ran off with the camera and actually managed to get away with it. So we have everything on video.
You know, if you could send us that video, Justin, we'll put it up on the lawanddisorder.org website, although I imagine it's gone up. Huh?
Well, they may need it for a law case.
Yeah. Well, when you feel like you're able to do it, we'd like to publicize this. We congratulate you on your initiative. Tell us some more about who the people involved in the occupation and what were they calling for, what they were doing. Tell us about that first night.
Well, I got there pretty late. That evening, I was kind of called out specifically to videotape because I think at the time I was called, they knew that there was going to be some interaction with police. And I'm kind of in the habit of videotaping police. I do a demonstration against torture on a pretty regular basis out in West Des Moines. So a friend of mine who was already down there asked me to come down. The people that were already there, basically, what I can say about them is that they were, the mission statement that was being read was something along the lines of standing in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street movement and kind of reclaiming government property that the government was claiming as their own and reclaiming it as the people's property. The park that the demonstration was actually taking place in was called People's Park. So,
that's perfect. Of course, videoing the cops is perfectly legal.
But, of course, they don't like that when you're filming them doing things that they obviously shouldn't be doing.
Now, Justin, we understand that the demonstrators who were arrested are actually asking to have jury trials.
Yes, that's correct.
And is Sally Frank, who's a longtime guild member, going to be doing some of the representation?
She's going to be doing some of the representation, I believe. But I think most of the people that are asking for jury trials and pleading not guilty are going to be representing themselves.
And what are they going to say in their own defense?
I guess I couldn't speak to what everybody else is going to be saying in their defense. I can speak for myself.
Please.
The state trooper motioned me off of public property and onto the property, which was closed, you know, basically tricked me into committing trespass. I was trying to obey the order to step back, you know, and then I get arrested for trespass. And then there's, of course, the absurd charge of interference, which this is the second time I've been charged with interference for videotaping police. And, of course, that doesn't meet the requirements of the law of interference with official acts.
And the officer essentially trapped and arrested you. We see that all around the country.
We saw it on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Exactly.
Heidi. 700 people.
But you had your own trap and arrest.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. It was an individually made trap and arrest. I felt very special.
At least it wasn't a snatch. You know, they also do that. They identify leaders of movements and literally go in and snatch them out of a crowd.
Yeah, I think, well, they did kind of do that with this group. At least two of the more well-known faces there. Ed Fallon was one of the guys that they went after first, and he is a former candidate for governor and has his own radio show. And I think he was like one of the first couple people that they immediately went after and arrested. So they kind of did that here. But, I mean, they definitely were identifying specific people and going after them, I think, in order. Oh, yeah, and they left the minors, I think, for the end. They arrested a 14-year-old and a 15-year-old, and I think that they were really not wanting to have very many people be witness to that.
Right.
I could tell they were not happy when I was pointing the camera at the 14-year-old and kind of sitting there waiting for them to arrest her. So.
Now, Justin, what is the public's response to all of this in Des Moines?
It's pretty conservative overall. And I think that the reaction to it has definitely been mixed, and I understand some of that. I think that I've been doing quite a bit of work protesting, like I said, protesting torture in West Des Moines for a while. I'm pretty used to people being like, very hostile in response to that. I didn't see a whole lot of that. I saw some of it downtown, like the second night that we were out. Some people would drive by, or they'd stop and they'd come over and yell at people, and you know, get into pretty heated arguments, and you know, criticize people for being lazy and so on. But it's interesting because I think people that criticize the movement usually pick out a couple of things that apply to arguments that people within the Occupy Wall Street movement. But just only a few people. You know, it's such a broad movement. It serves as an umbrella for a whole number of wide reasons that people would have to complain about the way that wealth is being spent in this country. You know, it's not just a whole bunch of people that are asking for handouts. There certainly are those people in a movement that's this huge. But there are people like myself. I mean, I'm just upset with how large the military budget is. I'd like to see that cut, and that's kind of one of the main reasons that I'm there. So I don't know. That's kind of the
isn't there
a little bit of the reaction? I kind of joined the movement at the last minute. I wasn't really. It fell in line with some of the things that I was already protesting: torture, the continuing existence of Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, and you know, I think that some of the things that I was concerned about fall under the umbrella of the Occupy Wall Street movement. So I think I can hop on board with some of the things that people are complaining about in the Occupy Wall Street movement, and it covers some of my own concerns as well. So also to be videotaped for people who might have bad encounters with the police, which is exactly what happened.
What concerns, Justin? You said cover some of my own concerns. What are they?
I'm 28 years old, and I am working. I've worked for myself over the past couple of years. I kind of make books and websites, and I'm doing fine as far as you know, income goes. But I can't really speak to you know what everybody else's situation is down there. I know I've heard some dismal stories from some people who, the guy who got maced, for instance, the 10-year Air Force vet was having a lot of difficulty finding a job right now.
Oh, you mean he's not
other
lazy?
People, yeah, of course. No. You know, often what you find is that, you know, people are just having a very difficult time finding a job. They're not lazy. They've tried very hard to find employment, but it's very difficult to do right now.
Justin, after the show of excessive police force, what do you think the protesters are going to do next in terms of regrouping? Are they deterred from going back?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. And I can only speak for the couple of days that followed the arrest, because I haven't been real involved in it since then. But what happened, basically, in my opinion, was that people got a bit frightened by the police brutality that they witnessed, and they decided to apply for a permit in the park, and they stayed there for about 3 days. The permit expired after 3 days, and then the mayor asked them to move to a different park, and they moved to that park, which I think is quite a bit less in the public eye than People's Park, which was right by the Capitol.
Hmm.
So that's what happened.
Why did they use the state troopers?
It's a good question. I don't know why, but the majority of the people that were there were state troopers, and I would guess that might have something to do with the amount of physicality that was shown, was maybe because state troopers aren't used to this, or maybe they, you know, this was a chance for some action for them. I don't know. But, yeah, I would guess that might have something to do with it.
When are your court dates starting?
We just got a continuance from the pretrial hearing to November 17th. So I think that's the next court date for me on that incident. I'm not sure what it is for everybody else.
And you're going to be going pro se. You're representing yourself, right, Justin?
Right, right.
Well, give us a preview, Justin. Pretend that Heidi and I are the jury, and you're standing up to address us. What are you going to say?
I think that the thing I'll have the most fun with is questioning the trooper who arrested me, or at least that sounds like it would be quite a bit of fun. At which point, sir, did you feel that I was a threat to you? You know, at which point did you feel like I was interfering with whatever it was that you were doing, and how was I doing that? I think that'll be interesting.
Well, Justin, we're really proud of you for standing out there when videotaping, even in the face of pepper spray and excessive use of force by police and troopers. And we wish you the best of luck, and we'll like to check in with you in a month or two to see how things are going.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, good luck, Justin Norman.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Pardis Kebriay presented oral arguments before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia in the case of Alzerani versus Rumsfeld. The case is a civil action filed on behalf of two men who died at Guantanamo Bay in the prison there in June of 2006. Their deaths were highly questionable. Last year, four soldiers came forward with eyewitness accounts suggesting a cover-up of the cause of the deaths, and they maintained that the people may have been killed at a black site called Camp No in Guantanamo. Against these whistleblowers, the military has maintained that the deaths were suicides, having once famously called them acts of asymmetrical warfare.
Also, CCR attorneys have pointed to other documented examples of deaths and killings covered up by the military in the recent past, including the falsification of the records in the death of former football player Pat Tillman and the premeditated murder of Afghan civilians by members of the Army's Bravo Company. Our own Michael Ratner has recently returned from Norway after meeting with family members of one of the men. We'll talk about that and the case that Pardis just argued in the district court. CCR attorney Pardis Cabriai.
Pardis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Pardis, you've been the main Center for Constitutional Rights attorney in the case of three alleged suicides that took place in Guantanamo. And you've been litigating the case, and there's a lot we want to talk about, and you just had to argue the case in the Court of Appeals. But give us a little background to remember what happened. These are three people who the government claimed committed suicide at Guantanamo.
Right. Yeah, this case is on behalf of the families of two of the three who died in June of 2006. And I'm sure people remember they were pretty high-profile deaths. The military came out immediately after they happened, I think the next morning, and said they were suicides, that the men had died by creating nooses from bed sheets and hung themselves in their cells. And then there were some pretty offensive remarks made by government spokespeople. They called them asymmetric warfare.
What is asymmetric warfare? You know, they always use that word whenever anybody injures themselves, supposedly.
Right.
But what is it? They also talk about Palestinians is engaging in asymmetric warfare.
Yeah, I mean, I think they saw this as an attack. You know, the fact that these men, if they had taken their own lives from having been detained without charge in solitary confinement for 4 years as an attack on the U.S. government, you know, basically, I think is maybe what they meant. But, you know, they were characterized as a good PR move and asymmetric warfare, and these were military and Department of State spokespeople who I guess are supposed to be somewhat more diplomatic, but it was actually a Department of State spokesperson who said these were a good PR move.
It's amazing, right? A guy kills himself at 20. One of the people, I think, I mean, you can talk about all of them, but the one, of course, that, I mean, they're all very sympathetic, but one was Yasser al-Sirani,
right,
who was 22 years old at the time he lost his life, and he was how old? 17 when he was brought into the
17.
Camp?
17. He was 17 when he was detained.
So tell us a little about him, because he's at least, you know, one of the people that his father was, we'll get to that, was with me in Norway recently when we were talking about this case. But who was Yasser?
Yasser was, like you said, he was 17. He was one of the juveniles who was taken into U.S. custody and detained at Guantanamo. And he's from Saudi Arabia. He, like almost everyone there, was not charged, held for 4 years without any kind of review. He was apparently a long-time hunger striker. And the Yemeni who died as well, Salah al-Salami, who's the other person we represent in this case, they were both long-term hunger strikers, which meant by 2005, I guess, Guantanamo had introduced this policy of force feeding. So in addition to the regular torture and solitary they were subjected to in terms of their conditions and just the torture of their detention in general, they were subjected to these force feedings where they're, you know, horrific, you know, description of being forced into restraint chairs where they were restrained at 5 points, their forehead, their shoulders, their wrists and ankles, had a tube inserted up their noses and a liter of fluid pumped through their nose into their stomach. And held in that position, restrained for 2 hours while the feeding occurred. So talk about those facts.
He was one of those. And now, after the three alleged suicide and after these statements by the U.S. officials, it was a publicity stunt or whatever they said to that effect, that evidence came out that all was not as the U.S. said. Can you just talk about what that evidence was?
Sure. So from 2006 to 2008, there was nothing at all, no information at all about what happened and then these deaths, even as suicides from the government, other than these public statements that they made on June 10th or 11th. In 2008, as a result of Freedom of Information Act litigation, the government was finally compelled to produce its information, its investigation into these deaths, its apparent investigation. That was an investigation by the military the investigative arm of the military itself. So that tells you something about how independent it might have been. But the NCIS is the National Criminal Investigative Service, is the investigative arm of the Navy, and they had investigated and basically in 2008 produced thousands of pages, most of which were actually redacted, but supporting their conclusion of suicide. And they had, again, redacted interviews, but interviews with soldiers, guards, autopsy reports, all supporting their claim that these were suicides. So in 2009, when we filed this case, that was really all the information we had. Obviously, the men themselves were dead, which would be the main source of information about what exactly happened. Access to Guantanamo, obviously, it was a black hole of information. There was absolutely no access to guards who might have been there, military personnel, former detainees. Our clients were really completely disadvantaged in terms of being able to investigate on their own and find out what happened, despite their questions. I don't think they ever believed that these were suicides, but all we had at the time of filing the case was this NCIS report that had come out saying that corroborating the conclusion that these deaths were suicide. We proceeded, we filed the case on that premise and proceeded on that basis. The case was dismissed, just like every other case that's been brought on behalf of former detainees for torture and arbitrary detention.
What were the grounds for dismissal?
They were, with respect to constitutional claims, very broadly, the court said, one, that the case raised special factors of national security and the military and foreign policy that were issues that are within the realm of the political branches and basically not the business of the courts to interfere in, so which is just a sweeping basis on which to dismiss constitutional claims. But that's one basis on which all of these cases for torture on behalf of victims of torture are being dismissed.
The Bush administration relied on that, and the Obama administration is also relying on that?
Both administrations are relying on it, but, it's not enough to just criticize the administrations anymore because the courts are accepting those arguments, at least in D.C., in terms of our case. And most of these cases that have been brought have been brought in the District of Columbia, which is where former officials, where there's a connection, obviously, to D.C., if you're in that district, which is where we are and where many of these cases are, the district courts and the circuit court in particular have been accepting those arguments. That was one basis. Second basis was even if we could prove that these men had been tortured, and this is, again, on the basis of the first complaint based on suicide, but even if we could prove they were tortured, killed themselves as a result of their desperation, were arbitrarily detained, even if all of that were true, federal officials at Guantanamo could not have known in 2006 that what they were doing was actually against the law and was unconstitutional, so they were protected by immunity.
It's that ruling has always been remarkable. It's the one that they always come to with one of our other clients when they sent him to Syria for torture, Makar Arar. They said, well, the U.S. official didn't know at the time they sent him for torture that it was against the law to send people outside the country for torture.
Right.
This is like saying U.S. officials didn't know at the time in Guantanamo it was against the law to beat the heck out of people and have them die.
Right.
I mean, it's like unbelievable. But let me bring you now to new evidence.
The facts, right.
What's the new evidence you have now that indicates that, when I read it, I think unquestionably demolishes the U.S. story. But why don't you tell us what that is?
Sure. So in January of 2010, four soldiers who were stationed at the base at Guantanamo at the time kind of amazingly came forward with accounts, eyewitness accounts, and the government has tried very hard to discredit what these men have said, but they were eyewitness accounts by four men who were stationed at the base and were actually on duty the night of the deaths, one of whom, who was the main sort of whistleblower, Joe Hickman, was actually Sergeant of the Guard at Guantanamo, which means that he was responsible for camp security, obviously entrusted with a lot of responsibility. But they came forward and basically, with their observations, provided evidence, direct evidence, of a cover-up, that there had been a cover-up of the actual cause of the death. They had facts like the morning after the death, Colonel Bumgarner, who was the commander at Guantanamo at the time, called a group of soldiers together and said, what you're going to hear is that these men hung themselves in their cells. Well, actually, they died from having rags stuffed down their throats. He didn't say they weren't suicides, but that fact alone demonstrates that there was a key aspect of how these men died that was being covered up. And there's direct, you know, eyewitness accounts, again, of hearing Bumgarner say that. And then, so there's specific things that undercut the main narrative of the military, which is that these men hung themselves in their cells, were transported from their cells to the medical clinic, and died at the medical clinic after attempts to resuscitate them. One of the other things two of the soldiers said is that they were on duty with, you know, unobstructed views of the path linking the camp the men supposedly died in and the medical clinic, saw no traffic at all in that pathway, which was the only path linking the camp and the clinic. So there are specific things like that that just undercut the military's narrative. And then on top of that, you put Joe Hickman's observations, which are that he was in the main watchtower over the main prison camp and observed a detainee transport van go from the camp, the specific camp where the men were held, load a detainee, an individual, into the van, drive off in the direction of the secret site called Camp No, come back 20 minutes later, pick up a second person, drive again to in the direction of Camp No, come back a third time, pick up a third detainee, drive again to Camp No, and then about 2.5-3 hours later, reappear, enter the camp, and drive up to the medical clinic, as he said, you know, to unload, as if they were going to unload something.
Now, it's a remarkable, that story, this is by an unimpeachable U.S. Army official who was on the ground at the time. And, of course, why don't you tell us about Camp No a little bit, just for a minute. Camp No has an interesting name, Camp No. What's that about? Right. Why is it called Camp No?
Well, apparently it was called Camp No because when people asked if it existed, they were told to say, no, it doesn't. So it took on this name of Camp No, and it was an unofficially unacknowledged site outside of the main perimeter of the camp. At Guantanamo, there is, you know, it's an entire military base covering 45 square miles, but the prison itself is in one specific area, and there is a perimeter around it, and that's where our client's sons and every other detainee at Guantanamo were detained and interrogated. Camp No was outside of that perimeter, and there's actually a map of the prison and this site in the article where these accounts appear, and that was in a Harper's Magazine article that Scott Horton is the journalist who published these accounts. But you can see the Camp No outside of this main perimeter where the main prison exists and operates. So there is nothing really known about it. I mean, I think, you know, in the article, Hickman and the other soldiers talk about having heard screams from Camp No. They reported seeing plainclothes officers sometimes going there. So it was thought to possibly be a site run by the CIA or used by the CIA or even perhaps secret Joint Special Operations Command forces of the military who, again, are not accountable and are not in the direct chain of command of the military. So this was clearly a covert, unofficially unacknowledged site where perhaps interrogations were happening, but we don't know.
We are speaking with Pardis Kebriay from the Center for Constitutional Rights, the lawyer who recently argued the Guantanamo murder death cases. And Pardis, tell us about the argument, because, you know, in some way, I mean, you've told me about it before, so I don't want to jump to the end here, but you had tremendous courage, I think. If you think of people standing up in the courts in 1939 in Germany, or people standing up in the Soviet Union at certain points to argue cases, the courts are technically open, but in some way, they're really not. So why don't you tell us a little about the argument?
Sure. You know, it was, I think, the disdain of the D.C. Circuit Court for this case and every case coming out of Guantanamo was just, you know, absolutely evident from the moment I opened my mouth. I went in actually expecting them to question the facts. Again, like I said, there's been criticism of Horton's article, attempts to try to discredit it, despite, again,
Horton's article, what you're referring to is the seminal article that came out about these deaths was
right.
Done by Scott Horton from Harper's Magazine, and it runs through in a way that Pardis has summarized the evidence of why the U.S. story is just that, a fairy tale.
Right. And in fact, I mean, despite the efforts to discredit it, it actually won the National Magazine Award for Excellence in Reporting, separate from the fact that the accounts the article publishes are not our own speculations or Scott Horton's, you know, theories. They're based on eyewitness observations from four soldiers themselves. But anyway, I expected to get a lot of questions about the facts. There were plenty of other issues to talk about with respect to our claims, but the only issue that the court wanted to discuss was whether it even had the power to hear the case, to have me even standing in court, whether our clients even had a right to be in court. So it was a 20-minute argument, and every question was about that issue, and that stems from specifically a provision of the Military Commissions Act, which was the act Congress passed in 2006 that stripped both jurisdiction of courts over habeas claims and any other claim relating to the detention, treatment, transfer conditions of anyone at Guantanamo. And the first part of that provision, the habeas strip, was invalidated by Boumediene. The question or the issue now is whether the second part of that strip was also invalidated by Boumediene. We say it was, that the Supreme Court in Boumediene referred to all of that provision, not just the specific provision about habeas, even though the very specific issue in Boumediene was about habeas. But our argument is that the entire provision was invalidated, even if it wasn't. Our argument is that it's unconstitutional. You can't deprive people of the right to be heard at all when they're raising claims of constitutional claims of torture and, in our case, alleged homicide. But that was the position of the government, is that the provision survived Boumediene, and even if it didn't, it's not it survived in that it's constitutional. And it was clear that the court, the panel of judges, I was before three judges, Centel, Randolph, and Williams, who were extremely hostile to the idea, not even of our allegations of homicide, torture, arbitrary detention, to any of those issues, but to the very idea that our clients even have the right to be in court.
I think that's a fundamental. That's really what's fundamental about this case, about some other ones you've worked on and argued. The question, really, you're very right to even walk into that court and even murder, torture, to even hear that case.
Well, it shows the consolidation of power by the executive, and these courts don't want to stick their neck out.
Which is absolutely what's happening. And like I said, I think the criticism really can't just be directed at the executive branch anymore. We've really got to take on what's happening in the courts, and in the D.C. Circuit Court in particular. Mm-hmm. That's a court that has repeatedly tried to deny rights to detainees at Guantanamo, but also people detained elsewhere by the United States in executive detention and who've been tortured. And again, actually, the Supreme Court has rejected the positions of the D.C. Circuit. So perhaps, we'll see what happens with this case, but it may be a case that we can try to take to the Supreme Court on this issue of even jurisdiction, just power of the court to hear the case.
When do you expect a ruling, Pardis?
I think probably in a few weeks. I think it was pre-written, so I can't imagine that they're going to spend a lot of time, but...
So now we have the three branches, the executive, the courts, and, of course, Congress passed a law that tried to cut you guys off as well. So have you been down to the fourth branch yet on Wall Street?
I haven't. But
that's the branch that's going to give you some hope. Go down there. You can get free lunch. But, Pardis, really, I really admire your courage in standing up to those three old white guys in robes. But anyway, whatever, sitting on that bench, it's really been its life.
Well, no, Michael, you made the reference before. It reminds you of what the judiciary was reduced to in the late 30s in Nazi Germany. Yeah. These people should stand up for human rights, and they duck the question and let people be murdered.
It's been an amazing fight. And as you know, and as Pardis knows, but our listeners don't, because Pardis had to make this argument that I had to take her place in Norway, where they're showing a film, Death in Camp Delta. And it's a film about these deaths that will be coming to the United States, brought by the center, I think, and sometime in January, we hope. And it does talk about and demonstrate all the questions that were raised about this case. And while I was in Norway, Talal al-Zarani is there, a Saudi Arabian former colonel in the Saudi military, I guess, yeah. And it's the father of Yasir. And, of course, he spoke very movingly about his son and about wanting to see some justice done. So, Pardis, your courage and your working on this case is really to be admired.
Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you, Pardis.
Thank you, Pardis.
Thank you all. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Meet the king of cowboys. He rides. Trail Pony. He fights the bad boys, brings them to their knees. He patrols the highways from the air. He keeps the country safe from long hair. I'm the masculine American man. I kill, therefore I am. I don't like the black man, for he does not know his place.
This is an Ashanti proverb in Ghana, which says, "Fefe nefe intina oba tumerika osone nufu na yese ebetia tonti," which means, "It is because of the beauty that is why a woman holds her breast when she runs, not because the breast is going to fall."
Fafana Fantina, or Batu Murica, or Son and Funa, yes, a Betty Atonti,
a Betty Atonti,
a Betty Atonti, hey,
a Betty Atonti,
a Betty Atonti, hey,
a Betty Atonti.
Now, fine, it's fine, where woman they hold in breast. When she dey run, God be say, the breast go fall for ground.
God be say, the breast go fall for ground.
God be say, the breast go fall for ground.
God be say, the breast go fall for ground.
Dida, loda, lo be reefing down your moon. Toba, sorry, go ship it to Rumajabo.
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 Now respect, I respect. Where I no answer you? Where you open your mouth for me? Let me say your mouth be past my own.
Let me say your mouth be past my own.
Let me say your mouth be past my own.
Let me say your mouth be past my own.
Let me say your mouth be past my own.
Let me say your mouth be past my own.
Pepenefentina. Oh, Batu Murica, O Son and Ufuna, yes, a Betty Atonti.
A Betty Atonti.
A Betty Atonti, hey, hey.